and for a long moment, after our lips touch, he's still as a statue. His eyes close, lashes brushing my cheek. I shudder, as you're supposed to when someone walks over your grave. Then his hands come up, gentle as they glide over my arms. If I didn't know better, I'd say his touch was reverent. But I do know better. His hands are moving slowly because he is trying to stop himself. He doesn't want this. He doesn't want to want this. He tastes like sour wine. I can feel the moment he gives in and gives up, pulling me to him despite the threat of the knife. He kisses me hard, with a kind of devouring desperation, fingers digging into my hair. Our mouths slide together, teeth over lips over tongues. Desire hits me like a kick to the stomach. It's like fighting, except what we're fighting for is to crawl inside each other's skin. That's the moment when terror seizes me. What kind of insane revenge is there in exulting in his revulsion? And worse, far worse, I like this. I like everything about kissing him. The familiar buzz of fear, the knowledge I am punishing him, the proof he wants me. The knife in my hand is useless. I throw it at the desk, barely registering as the point sinks into the wood. He pulls back from me at the sound, startled. His mouth is pink, his eyes dark. He sees the knife and barks out a startled laugh, which is enough to make me stagger back. I want to mock him, to show up his weakness without revealing mine, but I don't trust my face not to show too much. Is that what you imagined? I ask, and I'm relieved to find that my voice sounds harsh.
No,
he says tonelessly.
Tell me, I say.
He shakes his head, somewhere chagrined.
Unless you're really going to stab me, I think I won't. And I might not tell you, even if you were going to stab me.
I get up on Dane's desk to put some distance between us. My skin feels too tight, and the room seems suddenly too small. He almost made me laugh there.
I'm going to make a proposal,
Cardin says.
I don't want to put the crown on Baelkin's head just to lose mine. Ask whatever you want for yourself, for the Court of Shadows, but ask something for me. Get him to give me lands far from here. Tell him I will be gloriously irresponsible far from his side. He never needs to think of me again. He can sire some brat to be his heir and pass the high crown to it. Or perhaps it will slit his throat, a new family tradition. I care not.
I am grudgingly impressed that he's managed to come up with a fairly decent bargain, despite having been tied to a chair for most of the night, and probably quite drunk. Get up, I tell him.
So you're not worried I'm going to run for it?
He asks, stretching out his legs. His pointy boots gleam in the room, and I wonder if I should confiscate them since they're potential weapons. Then I remember how bad he is with a sword. After our kiss, I am such a fool over you I can hardly contain myself, I tell him with as much sarcasm as I can muster. All I want to do is nice things to make you happy. Sure, I'll make whatever bargain you want, so long as you kiss me again. Go ahead and run. I definitely won't shoot you in the back. He blinks a few times.
Hearing you lie outright is a bit disconcerting.
Then let me tell you the truth. You're not going to run because you've got nowhere to go. I head to the door, flip the lock, and look out. The bomb is lying on a cot in the sleeping room. The roach raises his eyebrows at me. The ghost is passed out in a chair, but he shakes himself awake when we come in. I feel flushed all over and hope I don't look it.
You done interrogating the princeling?
The roach asks. I nod. I think I know what I've got to do.
The ghost takes a long look at him.
So, are we selling? Buying? Cleaning his guts off the ceiling?
I'm going to take a walk, I say, to get some air. The roach sighs. I just need to put my thoughts in order, I say, and then I will explain everything.
Will you?
The ghost wants to know, fixing me with a look. I wonder if he guesses how easily promises are coming to my lips. I'm spending them like enchanted gold, doomed to turn back into dried leaves and tills all over town. I talked with Matic, and he offered me whatever I wanted in exchange for Cardin. Gold, magic, glory, anything. The first part of this bargain is struck, and I haven't even admitted I know where the lost prince might be. The ghost's lip curls at the mention of Matic, but he's silent.
So what's the holdup?
Asks the roach.
I like all those things.
I'm just working out the details, I say. And you need to tell me what you want. Exactly what you want. How much gold? What else? Write it down. The roach grunts but doesn't seem inclined to contradict me. He signals with one clawed hand for Cardin to return to the table. The prince staggers, pushing off the wall to get there. I make sure all the sharp things are where I left them, and then I head for the door. When I look back, I see Cardin's hands are deftly splitting the deck of cards, but his glittering black eyes are on me. I walk to the Lake of Masks and sit on one of the black rocks over the water. The setting sun has lit the sky on fire, set the tops of the trees ablaze. For a long time, I just sit there, watching the waves lap at the shoreline. I take deep breaths, waiting for my mind to settle, for my head to clear. Overhead, I hear the trilling of birds calling to one another as they roost for the night, and see glowing lights kindle in the hollow knotholes as sprites come awake. Baelkin cannot become the High King, not if there's anything I can do about it. He loves cruelty and hates mortals. He would be a terrible ruler. For now, there are rules dictating our interactions with the human world. Those rules could change. What if bargains were no longer needed to steal mortals away? What if anyone could be taken at any time? It used to be like that. It still is in some places. The High King could make both worlds far worse than they are, could favor the unseelie courts, could sow discord and terror for 1,000 years. So, instead, what if I turn Cardin over to Matic? He would put Oak on the throne and then rule as a tyrannical and brutal regent. He would make war on the courts that resisted swearing to the throne. He would raise Oak in enough bloodshed that he would turn into someone like Matic, or perhaps someone more secretly cruel, like Dane. He would be better than Baelkin, and he would make a fair bargain with me and with the Court of Shadows, if only for my sake. And I, what would I do? I could go with Vivi, I suppose. Or I could bargain to be a knight. I could stay and help protect Oak, help insulate him from Maddox's influence. Of course, I would have little power to do that. What would happen if I cut Matic out of the picture? That would mean no gold for the Court of Shadows, no bargains with anyone. It would mean getting the crown somehow and putting it on Oak's head. And then what? Matic would still become regent. I couldn't stop him. Oak would still listen to him. Oak would still become his puppet. Still be in danger. Unless somehow Oak could be crowned and spirited away from Faerie, be the High King in exile. Once Oak was grown and ready, he could return, aided by the power of the Greenbriar crown. Matic might still be able to assert some authority over Faerie until Oak got back. but he wouldn't be able to make Oak as bloodthirsty, as inclined toward war. He wouldn't have the absolute authority that he'd have as a regent with the High King beside him. And since Oak would have been reared in the human world, when he came back to Faerie, hopefully he'd be at least somewhat sympathetic to the place where he was raised and the people he met there. 10 years. If we could keep Oak out of Faerie for 10 years, he could grow into the person he's going to be. Of course, by then, he might have to fight to get his throne back. Someone. Probably Matic. Possibly Baelkin. Maybe even one of the minor kings or queens could squat there like a spider, consolidating power. I squint at the black water. If only there were a way to keep the throne unoccupied for long enough that Oak becomes his own person, without Matic making war, without any regent at all. I stand up, having made my decision. For good or ill, I know what I'm going to do. I have a plan. Matic would not approve of this strategy. It's not the kind he likes, where there are multiple ways to win. It's the kind where there's only one way. And it's kind of a long shot. As I stand, I catch my own reflection in the water. I look again and realize that it can't be me. The Lake of Masks never shows you your own face. I creep closer. The full moon is bright in the sky. Bright enough to show me my mother looking back at me. She's younger than I remember her. And she's laughing, calling over someone I cannot see. Through time, she points at me. When she speaks, I can read her lips. Look, a human girl. She appears delighted. Then Maddox's reflection joins hers, his hand going around her waist. He looks no younger then, but there is an openness in his face that I have never seen. He waves to me. I am a stranger to them. Run, I want to shout. But, of course, that's the one thing I don't need to tell her to do. The bomb looks up when I enter. She's sitting at the wooden table, measuring out a grayish powder. Beside her are several spun glass globes, corked shut. Her magnificent white hair is tied up with what looks like a piece of dirty string. A smear of grime streaks over her nose. The rest of them are in the back, she says, with the princeling, getting some sleep. I sit down at the table with a sigh. I'd been tensed up to explain myself, and now all that energy has nowhere to go. Is there anything around to eat? She gives me a quick grin as she fills another globe and sets it gingerly in a basket by her feet. The ghost picked up some black bread and butter. We ate the sausages, and the wine's gone, but there might still be some cheese. I rummage through the cupboard, take out the food, and then eat it mechanically. I pour myself a cup of bracing and bitter fennel tea. It makes me feel a little steadier. I watch her make explosives for a while. As she works, she whistles a little off-key. It's odd to hear. Most of the folk are musically gifted, but I like her tune better for being imperfect. It seems happier, easier, less haunting. Where will you go when all this is done? I ask her. She glances over at me, puzzled. What makes you think I'm going anywhere? I frown at my nearly empty cup of tea. Because Dane's gone. I mean, isn't that what the ghost and the roach are going to do? Aren't you going with them? The bomb shrugs her narrow shoulders and points a bare toe at the basket of globes. See all these? I nod. They don't travel well, she says. I'm going to stay here, with you. You've got a plan, right? I am too flummoxed to know what to say. I open my mouth and begin to stammer. She laughs. Cardin said that you did. That if you were just making a trade, you would have done it already. And if you were going to betray us, you'd have done that by now too. But, I say, and then lose my train of thought.
Something about how he wasn't supposed to be paying that much attention. What did the others think? She goes back to filling globes.
They didn't say, but none of us likes Baelkin. If you've got a plan, well, good for you. But if you want us on your side, maybe you could be a little less cagey about it.
I take a deep breath and decide that if I am really going to do this, I could use some help.
What do you think about stealing a crown? Right in front of the kings and queens of fairy.
Her grin curls up at the corners.
Just tell me when I get to blow up.
20 minutes later, I light the stub of a candle and make my way to the room with the cots. As the bomb said, Cardin is stretched out on one, looking sickeningly handsome. He's washed his face and taken off his jacket, which he has folded up under his head for a pillow. I poke him in the arm, and he comes awake instantly, raising his hand as though to ward me off.
Shh, I whisper. Don't wake the others. I need to talk to you.
Go away. You told me you wouldn't kill me if I answered your questions, and I did.
He doesn't sound like the boy who kissed me, sick with desire just hours ago. He sounds sleepy, arrogant, and annoyed.
I am going to offer you something better than your life, I say. Now, come on.
He stands, shouldering on his jacket, and then follows me into Dane's office. Once we're there, he leans against the door jamb. His eyes are heavy-lidded, his hair messy from the bed. Just looking at him makes me feel hot with shame.
You're sure you brought me here just to talk?
It turns out that having kissed someone, the possibility of kissing hangs over everything. No matter how terrible an idea it was the first time, the memory of his mouth on mine shimmers in the air between us. I brought you here to make a deal with you. His eyebrow goes up.
Intriguing.
What if you didn't have to go hide somewhere in the countryside? What if there were an alternative to Baelkin's being on the throne? That's clearly not what he was expecting me to say. For a moment, his insouciant swagger fails him.
There is,
he says slowly.
Me. Except I would be a terrible king, and I would hate it. Besides, Baelkin is unlikely to put the crown on my head. He and I have never gotten on particularly well.
I thought you lived in his house. I cross my arms over my chest protectively, trying to push away the image of Baelkin punishing Cardin. I can't have any sympathy now. He tips his head back, looking at me through dark lashes.
Maybe living together is the reason we don't get on.
I don't like you either, I remind him.
So you've said.
He gives me a lazy grin.
So if it's not me, and it's not Baelkin, then who?
My brother Oak, I tell him. I'm not going to go into how, but he's of the right bloodline. Your bloodline. He can wear the crown. Cardin frowns.
You're sure?
I nod. I don't like telling him this before I ask him to do what I need, but there's little he can do with the knowledge. I will never trade him to Baelkin. There is no one to tell but Matic, and he already knows.
So Matic will be regent,
Cardin says. I shake my head. That's why I need your help. I want you to crown Oak the High King. And then I'm going to send him to the mortal world. Let him have a chance to be a kid. Let him have a chance at being a good king someday.
Oak might make different choices than the ones you want him to,
Cardin says.
He might, for instance, prefer Matic to you.
I have been a stolen child, I tell him. I grew up in a foreign land for a far lonelier and worse reason than this. Vivi will care for him, and if you agree to my plan, I'll get you everything you asked for and more. But I need something from you. An oath. I want you to swear yourself into my service. He barks out the same surprised laugh he made when I threw my knife at the desk.
You want me to put myself in your power? Voluntarily?
You don't think I'm serious, but I am. I couldn't be more serious. Inside my crossed arms, I pinch my own skin to prevent any twitches, any tells. I need to seem completely composed, completely confident. My heart is speeding. I feel the way I did when I was a child, playing chess with Matic. I would see the winning moves ahead of me, forget to be cautious, and then be brought up short by a move of his I hadn't predicted. I remind myself to breathe, to concentrate.
Our interests align,
he says.
What do you need my oath for?
I take a deep breath. I need to be sure you won't betray me. You're too dangerous with the crown in your hands. What if you put it on your brother's head after all? What if you want it for yourself? He seems to think that over.
I'll tell you exactly what I want. The estates where I live. I want them given to me with everything and everyone in them. Hollow Hall. I want it.
I nod. Done.
I want every last bottle in the royal cellars, no matter how old or rare.
They will be yours, I say.
I want the roach to teach me how to steal, he says.
Surprised, I don't answer for a moment. Is he joking? He doesn't seem to be. Why? I ask finally.
It could come in useful,
he says.
Besides, I like him.
Fine, I say incredulously. I will find a way to work it out.
You really think you can promise all that?
He gives me a considering look. I can. I do. And I promise we will thwart Baelkin. We will get the crown of Faerie, I tell him heedlessly. How many promises can I make before I find myself accountable for them? A few more, I hope. Cardan throws himself into Dane's chair. From behind the desk, he gazes at me coolly from that position of authority. Something in my gut twists, but I ignore it. I can do this. I can do this. I hold my breath.
You can have my service for a year and a day,
he says. That's not long enough, I insist. I can't, he snorts.
I am sure that your brother will be crowned and gone by then. Or we will have lost, despite your promises, and it won't matter anyway. You won't get a better offer from me, especially not if you threaten me again.
It buys me time, at least. I let out my breath. Fine. We're agreed. Cardan crosses the room toward me, and I have no idea what he's going to do. If he kisses me, I'm afraid I will be consumed by the hungry and humiliating urgency that I felt the first time. But when he kneels down in front of me, I am too surprised to formulate any thoughts at all. He takes my hand in his, long fingers cool as they curl around mine.
Very well,
he says impatiently, not sounding in the least like a vassal about to swear to his lady.
Jude Duarte, daughter of Clay. I swear myself into your service. I will act as your hand. I will act as your shield. I will act in accordance with your will. Let it be so for 1 year and 1 day, and not for a minute more.
You've really improved the vow, I say, although my voice comes out strained. Even as he said the words, I felt like somehow he got the upper hand. Somehow, he's the one in control. He stands in one fluid motion, letting go of me.
Now what?
Go back to bed, I tell him. I'll wake you in a little while and explain what we've got to do.
As you command,
Cardan says, mocking smile pulling at his mouth. Then he goes back to the room with the cots, presumably to flop down on one. I think about all the strangeness of his being here, sleeping in homespun sheets, wearing the same clothes for days on end. eating bread and cheese, and not complaining about any of it. It almost seems like he prefers a nest of spies and assassins to the splendor of his own bed. Chapter 27. The monarchs of these Seelie and Unseelie courts, along with the wild, unallied fairies who came for the coronation, had made camp on the easternmost corner of the island. They had pitched tents, some in motley, some in diaphanous silks. When I get close, I can see fires burning. Honey wine and spoiled meat perfume the air. Cardin stands next to me, dressed in flat black, his dark hair combed away from a face scrubbed clean. He looks pale and tired, although I let him sleep as long as I dared. I didn't wake up the ghost or the roach after Cardin swore his oath. Instead, I talked strategy with the bomb for the better part of an hour. She is the one who got me the change of clothes for Cardin, the one who agreed he might come in useful. Which is how I came to be here, about to try to find a monarch willing to back a ruler other than Baelkin. If my plan is going to succeed, I need someone at that feast who is on the side of a new king. Preferably someone with the power to keep a dinner party from devolving into another slaughter if things go sideways. If nothing else, I'll need lots of disruptions to be sure I can get Oak out of there. The bomb's glass globes aren't going to be enough. What I'll have to offer in exchange, I am not entirely sure. I've spent all my own promises. Now I will begin spending the crowns. I take a deep breath. Once I stand in front of the lords and ladies of Faerie and declare my intent to go against Baelkin, there's no going back. No crawling under the coverlets in my bed. No running away. If I do this, I am bound to Faerie until Oak sits on the throne. We have tonight and half of tomorrow before the feast. Before I must go to Hollow Hall. Before my plans either come together or come entirely apart. There's only one way to keep Faerie ready for Oak. I have to stay. I have to use what I've learned from Matic and the Court of Shadows to manipulate and murder my way into keeping the throne ready for him. I said 10 years, but perhaps 7 will be enough. That's not so long. 7 years of drinking poison, of never sleeping, of living on high alert. 7 more years. And then maybe Faerie will be a safer, better land. And I will have earned my place in it. The Great Game, Locke had called it when he accused me of playing it. I wasn't then, but I am now. And maybe I learned something from Locke. He made me into a story. And now I am going to make a story out of someone else.
So I am to sit here and feed you information,
Cardin says, leaning against a hickory tree.
And you're going to charm royalty? That seems entirely backward.
I fix him with a look. I can be charming. I charmed you, didn't I? He rolls his eyes.
Do not expect others to share my depraved tastes.
I am going to command you, I tell him. Okay? A muscle jumps in his jaw. I am sure it is no small thing for a prince of Faerie to accept being controlled, especially by me. But he nods. I speak the words. I command you to stay here and wait until I am ready to leave this forest. There is imminent danger, or a full day has passed. While you wait, I command you to make no sound or signal to draw any others to you. If there is imminent danger, or a day has passed without my return, I command you to return to the Court of Shadows, concealing yourself as well as you are able until you are there.
That is not too poorly done,
he tells me, managing to retain his haughty, regal air somehow. It's annoying. Okay, I say. Tell me what you can about Queen Annet. What I know is this. She left the coronation ceremony before any of the other lords or ladies. That means she hates either the idea of Baelkin or the idea of any High Monarch. I just have to figure out which.
The Court of Moths is sprawling and very traditionally unseely. She's practical-minded and direct, and she values raw power over other things. I also heard she eats her lovers when she tires of them.
He raises his eyebrows. Despite myself, I smile. It's bizarre to be in this with Cardin, of all people. And weirder still for him to talk with me this way, as he might to Nikasia or Locke. So why did she walk out of the coronation? I ask. It sounds like she and Baelkin would be perfect for each other.
She has no heirs, he said, and despairs of ever bearing one. I think she would not have liked to see the wasteful slaughter of an entire line. Moreover, I don't think she would be impressed that Baelkin killed them all and still left the dais without a crown.
Okay, I say, sucking in a breath. He grabs hold of my wrist. I am shocked by the sensation of his skin warm against mine.
Take care,
he says, and then smiles.
It would be very dull to have to sit here for an entire day just because you went and got yourself killed.
My last thoughts would be of your boredom, I tell him, and head off toward Queen Annette's unseely encampment. No fires burn, and the tents are of a rough greenish fabric, the color of swamp. The sentries out in front are a troll and a goblin. The troll is wearing armor painted over in some dark color that seems too close to dried blood for comfort. Hello, I say, which I realize I need to work on. I'm a messenger. I need to see the queen. The troll peers down at me, obviously surprised to find a human before him.
And who dares send a delicious messenger to our court?
I think he might actually be flattering me, although it's hard to tell. The High King Baelkin, I lie. I figure using his name is the fastest way to get in. That makes him smile, although not in a friendly way.
What is a king without a crown? That's a riddle, but one to which we all know the answer. No king at all.
The other sentry laughs.
We will not let you pass, little morsel. Run back to your master and tell him that Queen Annette does not recognize him, though she appreciates his sense of spectacle. She will not dine with him no matter how many times he asks or what delectable bribes he sends along with his messages.
This isn't what you think, I say.
Very well. Tarry with us a while. I bet your bones would crunch sweetly.
The troll is all sharp teeth and mild threat. I know he doesn't mean it. If he meant it, he would have said something else entirely and just gobbled me up. Still, I back off. There are guest obligations on everyone who came for the coronation, but guest obligations among the folk are baroque enough that I am never sure if they protect me or not. Prince Cardin is waiting for me in the clearing, lying on his back, as though he's been counting stars. He looks a question at me, and I shake my head before I slump down in the grass. I didn't even get to talk to her, I say. He turns toward me, the moonlight highlighting the planes of his face, the sharpness of his cheekbones, and the points of his ears.
Then you did something wrong.
I want to snap at him, but he's right. I messed up. I need to be more formal, more sure that it is my right to be allowed in front of a monarch, as though I am used to it. I practiced everything I would say to her, but not how I would get to her. That part seemed easy. Now I can see that it won't be. I lie back beside him and look up at the stars. If I had time, I could make a chart and trace my luck in them. Fine. If you were me, whom would you apply to?
Lord Roybin and the Elder King's son, Severin.
His face is close to mine. I frown at him. But they're not part of the High Court. They haven't sworn to the crown.
Exactly,
Cardin says, reaching out a finger to trace the shape of my ear. The curve, I realize. I shudder, eyes closing against the hot spike of shame. He keeps talking, but he seems to realize what he's been doing and snatches his hand away. Now we're both ashamed.
They have less to lose and more to gain, throwing in with a plan that some might call treason. Severin reportedly favors a mortal knight and has a mortal lover, so he'll speak with you. And his father was an exile, so recognition of his court itself would be something. As for Lord Roybon, the stories make him seem like some figure in a tragedy. A Seely knight, tortured for decades as a servant in the unseely court he came to rule. I don't know what you offer someone like that, but he has a big enough court that if you got him to back Oak, even Balekin would be nervous. Other than that, I know he has a consort he favors, though she is of low rank. Try not to annoy her.
I remember Cardin drunkenly talking us past the guards on the way out of the coronation. He knows these people, knows their customs. No matter how high-handed he sounds giving advice or how much he bothers me, I would be a fool not to listen. I push myself to my feet, hoping there aren't hectic spots of red coloring my cheeks. Cardin sits up too, looking as though he's about to speak. I know, I say, starting toward the camp. Don't bore you by dying. I decide to try my luck with the Alder King's son, Severin, first. His camp is small, as is his domain. A stretch of woods just outside Roybon's court of termites, and neither seely nor unseely in nature. His tent is made of some heavy cloth, painted in silver and green. A few knights sit nearby around a cheerful fire. None of them are in armor. Just heavy leather tunics and boots. One is fussing with a contraption to suspend a kettle over the fire and boil water. The human boy I saw with Severin at the coronation, the redhead who caught me staring, is talking with one of the knights in a low voice. A moment later, they both laugh. No one pays me any notice. I march up to the fire. Your pardon, I say, wondering if even that is too polite for a royal messenger. Still, I have no choice but to barrel on. I have a message for the Alder King's son. The new High King wishes to come to an arrangement with him.
Oh, really?
The human surprises me by speaking first. Yes, mortal, I say, like the hypocrite I am. But come on, that's absolutely how one of Balekin's servants would talk to him. He rolls his eyes and says something to one of the other knights as he stands. It takes me a moment to realize I am looking at Lord Severin. Hair the color of autumn leaves and moss-green eyes, and horns curving from behind his brow to just above his ears. I am surprised at the thought of his sitting with the rest of his retinue before a fire, but I recover quickly enough to remember to bow. I must speak with you alone, I say.
Oh?
He queries. I do not respond, and his brows rise.
Of course, he says. This way. You should fix her,
the human boy calls after us.
Seriously, glamored human servants are creepy.
Severin doesn't answer him. I trail behind him into the tent. None of the others follow, although, when we get inside, there are some women in gowns sitting on cushions and a piper playing a little tune. A female knight sits beside them, her sword across her lap. The blade is beautiful enough to catch my eye. Severin leads me to a low table surrounded by tufted stools and piled with refreshments. A silver carafe of water with a horn handle, a platter of grapes and apricots, and a dish of little honeyed pastries. He gestures for me to sit, and when I do, he settles himself on another stool.
Eat whatever you wish,
he says, making it seem like an offer rather than a command. I want to ask you to witness a coronation ceremony, I say, ignoring the food. But Balekin's not the one who's going to be crowned. He doesn't look immensely surprised, just slightly more suspicious.
So you're not his messenger?
I am the next High King's messenger, I say. taking Cardin's ring from my pocket as proof that I have some connection to the royal family, that I am not just making up this story from whole cloth. Baelkin isn't going to be the next High King.
I see.
His effect is impassive, but his gaze is drawn to the ring. And I can promise you that your court will be recognized as sovereign if you help us. No threat of conquest from the new High King. Instead, we offer you an alliance. Fear crawls up my throat, and I almost can't say the words. If he won't help me, there's some chance he'll betray me to Baelkin. If that happens, things get a lot more difficult. I can control a lot, but I cannot control this. Severin's face is unreadable.
I am not going to insult you by asking whom you represent. There is only one possibility. The young Prince Cardin, of whom I hear many things. But I am not the ideal candidate to help you, for the very reasons your offer is so tempting. My court is afforded little consequence. And more, I am the son of a traitor, so my honor is unlikely to be given weight.
You're going to Baelkin's banquet already. All I need from you is aid at the critical moment. He's tempted. He admitted as much. Maybe he just needs some more convincing. Whatever you've heard about Prince Cardin, he will make a better king than his brother. At least there I am not lying. Severin glances toward the edge of the tent, as though wondering who can overhear me.
I will help you, so long as I am not the only one. I say this as much for your sake as for mine.
With that, he stands.
I wish you and the prince well. If you need me, I will do what I can.
I get up off the stool and bow again. You are most generous. As I leave his camp, my mind whirls. On one hand, I did it. I managed to speak with one of the rulers of Faerie without making a fool of myself. I even kind of persuaded him to go along with my plan. But I still need another monarch, a more influential one, to agree. There is one place I have been avoiding. The largest camp belongs to Roybin of the Court of Termites. Notoriously bloodthirsty, he won both of his crowns in battle, so he has no reason to object to Baelkin's blood-soaked coup. Still, Roybin seems to feel much the way Annet of the Court of Moths does, that Baelkin is of little consequence without a crown. Maybe he won't want to see one of Baelkin's messengers either. And, given the size of his encampment, I can't even imagine the number of guardians I would have to pass in order to speak with him. But possibly, I could sneak in. After all, with so many of the folk around, what is one person, more or less? I gather up a bundle of fallen branches, large enough to be a respectable contribution to a fire, and walk toward the termite camp with my head down. There are knights posted around the perimeter, but, indeed, they pay me little mind as I walk past. I feel giddy with the success of my plan. When I was a child, sometimes Maddock would have to stop in the middle of a game of Nine Men's Morris. The board would remain as it was, waiting for us to resume. All through the day and the night, I would imagine my moves and his countermoves until, when we sat down, we were no longer playing the original game. Most often, what I failed to do was accurately anticipate his next moves. I had a great strategy for me, but not for the game I was in. That's how I feel now, walking into the camp. I am playing a game opposite Matic, and while I can spin out plans and schemes, if I can't accurately guess his, I am sunk. I drop the kindling beside a fire. A blue-skinned woman with black teeth regards me for a moment and then goes back to her conversation with a goat-footed man. Dusting the bark from my clothes, I walk toward the largest tent. I keep my step light and my stride easy and even. When I find a patch of shadow, I use it to crawl under the edge of the cloth. For a moment, I lie there, half hidden on both sides and completely hidden on neither. The inside of the main tent is lit with lanterns burning with green alchemical fire, tinting everything a sickly color. In every other way, however, the interior is lush. Carpets are layered, one over another. There are heavy wooden tables, chairs, and a bed piled with furs, and brocade coverlets stitched with pomegranates. But on the table, to my surprise, are paper cartons of food. The green-skinned pixie who was with Roybin at the coronation uses chopsticks to bring noodles to her mouth. He sits beside her, carefully breaking apart a fortune cookie.
"What does it say?"
the girl asks.
"How about the trip you told your girlfriend would be fun ended in bloodshed as usual?"
"It says, your shoes will make you happy today,"
he tells her, voice dry, and passes a little slip across the table for her verification. She glances down at his leather boots. He shrugs, a small smile touching his lips. Then I'm dragged roughly out from my hiding place. I roll onto my back outside the tent to find a knight standing above me, her sword drawn. There is no one to blame but myself. I should have kept moving, should have found a way to hide myself inside the tent. I should not have stopped to listen to a conversation, no matter how surprising I found it.
"Get up,"
the knight says. Dulcamera. Her face shows no recognition of me, however. I stand, and she marches me into the tent, kicking me in the legs once we get there so I topple onto the rugs. I have cause to be thankful for their plushness. For a moment, I let myself lie there. She presses her boot against the small of my back, as though I am some felled prey.
"I caught a spy," she announces.
"Shall I snap its neck?" I could roll over and grab her ankle. That would throw her off balance for long enough that I could get up. If I twisted her leg and ran, I might be able to get away. At worst, I'd be on my feet, able to grab a weapon and fight her. But I came here to have an audience with Lord Roybin, and now I have one. I stay still and let Dulcamera underestimate me. Lord Roybin has come around from the table and bends over me, white hair falling around his face. Silver eyes regard me pitilessly.
"And whose court are you a part of?"
"The High King's," I say. "The true High King, Eldred, who was felled by his son."
"I am not sure I believe you."
He surprises me both with the mildness of the statement and with the assumption that I am lying.
"Come sit with us and eat. I would hear more of your tale. Dulcamera, you may leave us."
"You're going to feed it?" she asks sulkily. He does not answer her, and after a moment of stony silence, she seems to remember herself. With a bow, she leaves. I go to the table. The pixie regards me with her ink-drop black eyes like tatterfells. I notice the extra joint in her fingers as she reaches for an egg roll.
"Go ahead," she says. "There's plenty. I used most of the hot mustard packets, though."
Roybin waits, watching me. "Mortal food," I say, in what I hope is a neutral way.
"We live alongside mortals, do we not?"
he asks me.
"I think she more than lives beside them,"
the pixie objects, looking at me.
"Your pardon,"
he says, and waits. I realize they really expect me to eat something. I spear a dumpling with a single chopstick and stuff it into my mouth.
"It's good."
The pixie resumes eating noodles. Roybin gestures to her.
"This is Kay. I imagine you know who I am, since you snuck into my camp. What name might you go by?"
I'm unused to such scrupulous politeness being afforded to me. He's doing me the courtesy of not asking for my true name. "Jude," I say, because names have no power over mortals. "And I came to see you because I can put someone other than Baelkin on the throne. But I need your help to do it."
"Someone better than Baelkin? Or just someone?"
he asks. I frown, not sure how to answer that. Someone who didn't murder most of his family on stage. Isn't that automatically better? The pixie, Kay, snorts. Lord Roybin looks down at his hand, on the wooden table, then back at me. I cannot read his grim face.
Bilkin is no diplomat, but perhaps he can learn. He's obviously ambitious, and he pulled off a brutal coup. Not everyone has the stomach for that.
I almost didn't have the stomach to watch it, Kay says.
He only sort of pulled it off, I remind them. And I didn't think you liked him very much, given what you said at the coronation. A corner of Roybin's mouth turns up. It is a gesture in miniature, barely noticeable.
I don't. I think he's a coward to kill his sisters and father in what appeared to be a fit of pique. And he hid behind his military, letting his general finish off the High King's chosen heir. That bespeaks weakness, the kind that will inevitably be exploited.
A cold chill of premonition shivers up my back. What I need is someone to witness a coronation. Someone with enough power that the witnessing will matter.
You.
It will happen at Bailkin's feast, tomorrow eve. If you'll just allow it to happen and give your oath to the new High King.
No offense, Kay says. But what do you have to do with any of this? Why do you care who gets the throne?
Because this is where I live, I say. This is where I grew up. Even if I hate it half the time, it's mine. Lord Roybin nods slowly.
And you are not going to tell me who this candidate is, nor how you're going to get a crown on his head?
I'd rather not, I say.
I could get Dulcamera to hurt you until you begged to be allowed to tell me your secrets.
He says this mildly, just another fact. But it reminds me of just how horrific his reputation is. No amount of takeout Chinese food or politeness ought to make me forget exactly who and what I am dealing with. Wouldn't that make you as much of a coward as Bailkin? I ask, trying to project the same confidence I did in the Court of Shadows, the same confidence I did with Cardin. I can't let him see that I'm scared, or, at least, not how scared I am. We study each other for a long moment, the pixie watching us both. Finally, Lord Roybin lets out a long breath.
Probably more of a coward. Very well, Jude. Kingmaker, we will gamble with you. Put the crown on a head other than Bailkin's, and I will help you keep it there.
He pauses.
But you will do something for me.
I wait, tense. He steeples his long fingers.
Someday, I will ask your king for a favor.
You want me to agree to something without even knowing what it is? I blurt out. His stoic face gives little away.
Now we understand each other exactly.
I nod. What choice do I have? Something of equal value, I clarify. And within our power.
This has been a most interesting meeting,
Lord Roybin says, with a small, inscrutable smile. As I stand to leave, Kay winks an ink-drop eye at me.
Luck? Mortal.
With her words echoing after me, I leave the encampments and head back to Cardin. Chapter 28. The ghost is up when we return. He had been out and brought back with him a handful of tiny apples, some dried venison, fresh butter, and several dozen more bottles of wine. He's also brought down a few pieces of furniture I recognize from the palace. A silk-embroidered divan, satin cushions, a shimmering spider silk throw, and a chalcedony set of tea things. He looks up from the divan where he is sitting, appearing both tense and exhausted. I think he's grieving, but not in a human way.
Well, I believe I was promised gold.
What if I could promise you revenge? I ask. conscious once again of the weight of debts already on my shoulders. He trades a look with the balm.
So, she really does have a scheme.
The balm settles herself on a cushion. A secret, which is far better than a scheme. I grab an apple, go to the table, and then hoist myself onto it. We're going to walk right into Baelkin's feast and steal his kingdom out from under him.
How's that for vengeance?
Bold. That's what I need to be. Like I own the place. Like I am the general's daughter. Like I can really pull this off. The corner of the ghost's mouth turns up. He takes out 4 silver cups from the cupboard and sets them before me.
Drink?
I shake my head, watching him pour. He returns to the divan, but rests at the edge, as though he's going to have to jump up in a moment. He takes a big swallow of wine. You spoke of the murder of Dane's unborn child, I say. The ghost nods.
I saw your face when Cardin spoke of Lariope, and when you understood my part in it.
It surprised me, I say honestly. I wanted to think Dane was different. Cardin snorts and takes the silver cup that was meant for me as well as his own.
Murder is a cruel trade, says the ghost. I believe Dane would have been as fair a high king as any prince of the folk. But my father was mortal. He would not have considered Dane to be good. He would not have considered me good, either. You'd do well to decide how much you care for goodness before you go too far down the road of spycraft.
He's probably right, but there's little time for me to consider it now. You don't understand, I tell him. Lariope's child lived. He turns to the bomb, clearly astonished.
That's the secret?
She nods, a little smug. That's the scheme. The ghost gives her a long look and then turns his gaze to me.
I don't want to find a new position. I want to stay here and serve the next High King. So yes, let's steal the kingdom.
We don't need to be good, I tell the ghost. But let's try to be fair. As fair as any prince a fairy. The ghost smiles. And maybe a little fairer, I say, with a look at Cardin. The ghost nods.
I'd like that.
Then he goes to wake the roach. I have to explain all over again. Once I get to the part about the banquet and what I think is going to happen, the roach interrupts me so many times I can barely get a sentence out. After I'm done speaking, he removes a roll of vellum and a nibbed pen from one of the cabinets and notes down who ought to be where at what point for the plan to work.
You're replanning my plan, I say.
Just a little,
he says, licking the nib and beginning to write again.
Are you concerned over Maddock? He won't like this.
Of course I am concerned about Maddock.
If I wasn't, I wouldn't be doing any of this. I would just hand him the living key to the kingdom.
I know, I say, gazing at the dregs of wine in the ghost's glass.
The moment I walk into the feast with Cardin on my arm, Maddock will know I am running a game of my own. When he discovers that I am going to cheat him out of being regent, he'll be furious. And he's at his most bloodthirsty when he's furious.
Do you have something appropriate to wear?
The roach asks. At my surprised look, he throws up his hands.
You're playing politics. You and Cardin need to be turned out in splendor for this banquet. Your new king will need everything to look right.
We go over the plans again, and Cardin helps us map out Hollow Hall. I try not to be too conscious of his long fingers tracing over the paper, of the sick thrill I get when he looks at me. At dawn, I drink 3 cups of tea and set out alone for the last person I must speak with before the banquet. My sister, Vivienne. I go back to my house. Maddox's house. I remind myself. Never really mine. Never mine again after tonight. As the sun rises in a blaze of gold, I feel like a shadow as I climb the spiral stairs, as I pass through all the rooms I grew up in. In my bedroom, I pack a bag. Poison, knives, a gown, and jewels that I think the roach will find to be properly extravagant. With reluctance, I leave behind the stuffed animals from my bed. I leave slippers and books and my favorite baubles. I step out of my second life the same way I stepped out of my first, holding too few things and with great uncertainty about what will happen next. Then I go to Vivi's door. I rap softly. After a few moments, she sleepily lets me inside. "Oh, good," she mumbles, yawning. "You're packed." Then she catches sight of my face and shakes her head. "Please don't tell me you're not coming." "Something happened," I say, resting my bag on the ground. I keep my voice low. There's no real reason to hide that I am here, but hiding has become habit. "Just hear me out."
"You disappeared," she says. "I've been waiting and waiting for you, trying to act like things were fine in front of Dad. You made me worry."
"I know," I say. She looks at me like she's considering giving me a swift smack.
"I was afraid you were dead."
"I'm not even a little bit dead," I say, taking her arm and pulling her close so I can speak in a whisper. "But I have to tell you something I know you're not going to like. I have been working as a spy for Prince Dane. He put me under a gesh, so I couldn't have said anything before his death." Her delicately pointed eyebrows rise.
"Spying? What does that entail?"
"Sneaking around and getting information. Killing people. And before you say anything else, I was good at it."
"Okay," she says.
She knew something was up with me, but from her face, I can tell that in a million years, she wouldn't have guessed this. I go on, and I discovered that Matic is going to make a political move, one that involves Oak. I explain once more about Liriope and Oriana and Dane. By this point, I have told this story enough that it's easy to hit only the necessary parts, to run through the information quickly and convincingly. Matic is going to make Oak king and himself regent. I don't know if that was always his plan, but I'm sure it's his plan now.
"And that's why you're not coming to the human world with me?"
"I want you to take Oak instead," I tell her. "Keep him away from all this until he gets a little older. Old enough not to need a regent. I'll stay here and make sure he has something to come back to." Vivi puts her hands on her hips, a gesture that reminds me of our mother.
"And how exactly are you going to do that?"
"Leave that part to me," I say, wishing that Vivi didn't know me quite as well as she does. To distract her, I explain about Baelkin's banquet, about how the Court of Shadows is going to help me get the crown. I am going to need her to prep Oak for the coronation. "Whoever controls the king, controls the kingdom," I say. "If Matic is regent, you know that Fairy will always be at war."
"So, let me get this straight. You want me to take Oak away from Fairy, away from everyone he knows, and teach him to be a good king?"
She laughs mirthlessly.
"Our mother once stole a fairy child away. Me. You know what happened. How will this be any different? How will you keep Matic and Baelkin from hunting Oak to the ends of the earth?"
"Someone can be sent to guard him, to guard all of you. But, as for the rest, I have a plan. Matic won't follow. With Vivi, I feel forever doomed to be the little sister, foolish and about to topple over onto my face."
"Maybe I don't want to play nursemaid," Vivi says. "Maybe I will lose him in a parking garage or forget him at school. Maybe I would teach him awful tricks. Maybe he would blame me for all this. Give me another solution. You really think this is what I want? I know I sound like I am pleading with her, but I can't help it. For a tense moment, we look at each other. Then she sits down, hard in a chair, and lets her head fall back against the cushion.
How am I going to explain this to Heather?
I think Oak is the least shocking part of what you have to tell her, I say. And it's just for a few years. You're immortal, which, by the way, is one of the more shocking things you have to tell her. She gives me a glare fit to singe hair.
Make me a promise that this is going to save Oak's life.
I promise, I tell her.
And make me another promise that it's not going to cost you yours.
I nod. It won't.
Liar, she says. You're a dirty liar, and I hate it. And I hate this.
Yeah, I say. I know. At least she didn't say she hated me, too. I am on my way out of the house when Taryn opens her bedroom door. She's dressed in a skirt the color of ivy, with stitching picking out a pattern of falling leaves. My breath catches. I wasn't planning to see her. We regard each other for a long moment. She takes in that there's a bag over my shoulder, and that I'm in the same clothes I wore when we fought. Then she closes her door again, leaving me to my fate. Chapter 29. Never have I walked through the front doors of Hollow Hall. Always before I have come skulking through the kitchens, dressed as a servant. Now I stand in front of the polished wooden doors, lit by two lamps of trapped sprites who fly in desperate circles. They illuminate a carving of an enormous and sinister face. The knocker, a circle piercing its nose. Cardin reaches for it, and because I have grown up in Faerie, I am not entirely surprised into a scream when the door's eyes open.
My prince,
it says.
My door,
he says in return, with a smile that conveys both affection and familiarity. It's bizarre to see his obnoxious charm used for something other than evil.
Hail and welcome,
the door says, swinging open to reveal one of Baelkin's fairy servants. He stares open-mouthed at Cardin, missing Prince of Faerie.
The other guests are through there,
the servant finally manages. Cardin tucks my arm firmly through his before striding into the entryway, and I feel a rush of warmth as I match his step. I can't afford to be less than ruthlessly honest with myself. Against my better judgment, despite the fact that he is terrible, Cardin is also fun. Maybe I should be glad of how little it will matter. But for now, it's immensely unnerving. Cardin is dressed in a suit of Dane's clothes, stolen from the palace wardrobes and altered by a clever-fingered brownie that owed the Roach a gambling debt. He looks regal in different shades of cream, a coat over a vest and loose shirt, breeches and a neckcloth, with the same silver-tipped boots he wore to the coronation, a single sapphire shining from his left ear. He's supposed to look regal. I helped choose the clothes, helped make him this way. And yet the effect is not lost on me. I am wearing a bottle green gown with earrings in the shape of berries. In my pocket is Liriope's golden acorn. And at my hip is my father's sword. Against my skin, I have a collection of knives. It doesn't feel like enough. As we cross the floor, everyone turns to look. The lords and ladies of Faerie, kings and queens of other courts, the representative from the Queen of the Undersea, Baelkin, my family, Oak, standing with Orianna, and Matic. I look over at Lord Roybin, his white hair making him easy to find in the crowd. But he does not acknowledge that we have ever met. His face remains unreadable. A mask.
I'm going to have to trust that he will keep his part of the bargain. But I mislike this kind of calculation. I grew up thinking of strategy as finding weaknesses and exploiting them. That I understand. But making people like you, making people want to take your part and be on your side, that I am far less skilled at. My gaze goes from a table of refreshments to the elaborate gowns to a goblin king crunching on a bone. Then my eyes settle on the blood crown of the High King. It rests on a ledge above us, a pillow beneath it. There, it glows with a sinister light. At the sight, I imagine all my plans coming apart. The thought of stealing it, in front of everyone, daunts me. And yet, having to search Hollow Hall for it would have been daunting too. I see Baelkin move from speaking with a woman I don't recognize. She's wearing a gown of woven seaweed and a collar of pearls. Her black hair is tied to a crown festooned with more pearls, appearing like webbing above her head. It takes me a moment to puzzle out who she must be. Queen Orla,
Nikasia's mother.
Baelkin leaves her and crosses the room toward us with purpose. Cardan catches sight of Baelkin and steers us in the direction of the wine. Bottles and carafes of it. Pale green, yellow as gold, the dark purple red of my heart's own blood. They are redolent of roses, of dandelions, of crushed herbs and currants. The smell alone nearly makes my head spin.
Little brother,
Baelkin says to Cardan. He is dressed head to toe in black and silver. The velvet of his doublet so thickly embroidered with patterns of crowns and birds that it looks as heavy as armor. He wears a silver circlet on his brow, matching his eyes. It's not the crown, but it is a crown.
I've sought high and low for you. Doubtless so.
Cardan smiles like the villain I've always believed him to be.
I turned out to be useful after all. What a terrible surprise.
Prince Baelkin smiles back as though their smiles could duel without the rest of them even being involved. I am sure he wishes he could rail at Cardan, could beat him into doing what he wants. But since the rest of their family died at Swordpoint, Baelkin must have learned his lesson about needing a willing participant in a coronation. For the moment, Cardan's presence is enough to reassure people that Baelkin will soon be the High King. If Baelkin calls for guards or grabs him, that illusion will dissipate.
And you,
Baelkin says, turning his gaze to me, viciousness lighting his eyes.
What have you to do with this? Leave us. Jude,
Maddox says, striding up to stand beside Prince Baelkin, who immediately seems to realize, I might have something to do with this after all. Maddox looks displeased, but not alarmed. I am sure he is thinking me a fool who expects to get a pat on the head for finding the missing prince, and cursing himself for not making it more clear that he wanted Cardan brought to him and not to Baelkin. I give him my best blithe smile, like a girl who thinks she has solved everyone's problems. How frustrating it must be to come so close to your goal. To have Oak and the crown in one place. To have the lords and ladies of Faerie assembled. And then your first wife's bastard throws a spanner in the works by handing the one person most likely to put the crown on Oak's head to your rival. I note the evaluating look he's giving Cardan, however. He's replanning. He rests a heavy hand on my shoulder.
You found him.
He turns to Baelkin.
I hope you're intending to reward my daughter. I am sure it took no small amount of persuasion to bring him here.
Cardan gives Maddox an odd look. I remember what he said about it bothering him that Maddox treated me so well when Eldred barely acknowledged him. But the way he's looking, I wonder if it's just weird to see us together. Red Cap General and Human Girl.
I will give her anything she asks for, and more.
Baelkin promises extravagantly. I see Maddock frown, and I give him a quick smile, pouring two glasses of wine, one light and the other dark. I am careful with them, sly-fingered. I do not spill a drop. Instead of handing one to Carden, I offer them both up for Maddock to choose between. Smiling, he takes the one the color of heart's blood. I take the other. To the future of Faerie, I say, tapping the globes together, making the glass ring like bells. We drink. Immediately I feel the effects, a kind of floatiness, as though I am swimming through air. I don't want to even look at Carden. He will laugh and laugh if he thinks I can't handle a few sips of wine. Carden pours his own glass and throws it back.
Take the bottle,
Bilkin says.
I am prepared to be very generous. Let us discuss what you'd like, whatever you'd like. There's no hurry, is there?
Carden asks lazily. Bilkin gives him the hard stare of someone barely holding himself back from violence.
I think everyone would like to see the matter settled.
Nonetheless, Carden says, taking the bottle of wine and drinking directly from the neck.
We have all night. The power is in your hands,
Bilkin tells him in a clipped way that leaves the "for now" heavily implied. I see a muscle twitch in Carden's jaw. I am sure Bilkin is imagining how he will punish Carden for any delay. It weighs down his every word. Maddock, by contrast, is taking in the situation, evaluating, no doubt, what he can offer Carden. When he smiles at me and takes another swig of his wine, it's a real smile, toothy and relieved. I can see he's thinking that Carden will be easier to manipulate than Bilkin ever would have been. I'm suddenly certain that if we went into the other room, Bilkin would find Maddock's sword buried in his chest.
After dinner, I will tell you my terms,
Carden says.
But until then, I am going to enjoy the party. I do not have endless patience,
Bilkin growls.
Cultivate it,
Carden says. And with a small bow, he navigates us away from Bilkin and Maddock. I leave my glass of wine near a platter of sparrow hearts, pierced through with long silver pins, and weave through the crowd with him. Nikasia stops us with a long-fingered hand against Carden's chest, her cerulean hair bright against her bronze gown.
Where have you been?
Nikasia asks, with a glance at our linked arms. She wrinkles her delicate nose, but panic underlines her words. She is feigning calm, like the rest of us. I am sure that she thought Carden had to be dead, or worse. There must be many things she wants to ask him, all of which she cannot do in front of me.
Jude here made me her prisoner,
he says, and I have to fight down the urge to step heavily on his foot.
She ties very tight knots.
Nikasia clearly doesn't know whether to laugh. I almost sympathize. I don't know either.
Good thing you finally managed to slip her bonds,
Nikasia decides on. He raises both brows.
Did I?
He asks, with a haughty condescension, as though she has shown herself to be less clever than he had hoped.
Must you be like this, even now? She asks, clearly deciding to throw caution to the wind.
Her hand goes to his arm. His face softens in a way that I am entirely unused to seeing.
Nikasia,
he says, pulling himself free.
Stay away from me tonight. For your own sake.
It stings a little that he has that kindness in him. I don't want to see it. She gives me a look, doubtlessly trying to decide why his pronouncement doesn't apply to me. But then Carden is moving away from her, and I go with him. I see Taryn across the room, Locke beside her. Her eyes widen, taking in whom I am standing with. Something passes over her face, and it looks a lot like resentment. She has Locke, but I am here with a prince. That's not fair. I cannot know she is thinking that from just one look. Part one completed, I say, looking away from her, speaking to Cardin under my breath. We got here, got in, and are not yet in chains.
Yes,
he says.
I believe the Roach called that the easy bit.
The plan, as I've explained it to him, has five basic phases. One, get in. Two, get everybody else in. Three, get the crown. Four, put the crown on Oak's head. And five, get out. I take my arm from his. Don't go anywhere alone, I remind Cardin. He gives me the tight-lipped smile of someone who's being abandoned, and nods once. I head toward Oriana and Oak. On the other side of the room, I see Severin break off from a conversation and walk toward Prince Balekin. Sweat beads on my lip, under my arms. My muscles tense. If Severin says the wrong thing, I am going to have to abandon all phases of the plan except for get out. Oriana raises both brows as I approach, her hands going to Oak's thin shoulders. He reaches up his hands. I want to swing him up into my arms. I want to ask him if Vivi explained what's going to happen. I want to tell him everything's going to be fine. But Oriana grabs his fingers, pressing them between hers, settling the question of how many lies I could stomach. What is this? Oriana asks me, with a nod toward Cardin. What you asked, I tell her, following her gaze. Somehow, Balekin has drawn Cardin into his conversation with Severin. Cardin laughs at something Balekin said, looking as comfortably arrogant as I've ever seen him. I am shocked by recognition. If you live your life always afraid, always with danger on your heels, it is not so difficult to pretend away more danger. I know that. But I didn't think, of all people, Cardin would too. Balekin has his hand on Cardin's shoulder. I can just imagine his fingers digging into Cardin's neck. It's not easy. I hope you understand there's going to be a price. I'll pay it, she says quickly. None of us knows the cost, I snap, and then hope no one notices the sharpness of my tone. And we're all going to have to pay our share. My skin has a fine flush on it from the wine, and there's a metallic taste in my mouth. It's nearly time to put the next part of the plan into effect. I glance around for Vivi, but she's across the room. There's no time to say anything to her now, even if I knew what to say. I give Oak what I hope is an encouraging smile. I have often wondered if my past is the reason I am the way I am, if it has made me monstrous. If so, will I make a monster out of him? Vivi won't, I tell myself. Her job is to help him care about things other than power. And my job is to care only about power so I can carve out room for his return. With a deep breath, I head toward the doors out into the hallway. I pass the pair of knights and turn a corner, out of their sightline. I gulp down a few breaths before unlatching the windows. I wait a few hopeful moments. If the Roach and the ghost climb through, I can explain the crown's location. But instead, the doors to the banquet open, and I hear Matic order the knights off. I move so that he can see me. When he does, he comes toward me with purpose.
Jude, I thought you came this way.
I needed some fresh air, I tell him, which is indicative of how nerved up I am. I have answered the question he hasn't yet asked. He waves it off, though.
You should have come to me first when you found Prince Cardin. We could have negotiated from a position of strength.
I thought you might say something like that, I tell him.
What matters now is that I need to speak with him alone. I'd like you to go inside and bring him out here so we can talk. All three of us can talk.
I move away from the window, into the open space of the hall. The ghost and the Roach will be here in a moment, and I don't want Matic to spot them. About Oak? I ask.
As I had hoped, Maddock follows me away from the window, frowning.
You knew?
That you have a plan for ruling Elfheim yourself? I ask him. I figured it out. He stares at me as though I am a stranger. But I have never felt less like one. For the first time, we are both unmasked.
And yet, you brought Prince Cardin here, right to Baelkin,
he says.
Or to me, is that it? Are we to bargain now?
It must be one or the other, right? I say. He's growing angry.
Would you prefer no High King at all? If the crown is destroyed, there will be war. And if there's war, I will win it. One way or another, I will have that crown, Jude. And you stand to benefit when I do. There's no reason to oppose me. You can have your knighthood. You can have all the things you've ever dreamed of.
He takes another step toward me. We are in striking distance of each other. You said, I will have that crown. You, I remind him, my hand going to the hilt of my sword. You've barely spoken Oak's name. He is just a means to an end, and that end is power. Power for you.
Jude,
he begins, but I cut him off. I'll make a bargain. Swear to me that you'll never raise a hand against Oak. And I'll help. Promise me that when he comes of age, you will immediately step down as regent. You'll give him whatever power you'll have amassed, and you'll do it willingly. Maddock's mouth twists, his hands fist. I know he loves Oak. He loves me. I'm sure he loved my mother, too, in his own way. But he is who and what he is. I know he cannot promise. I draw my sword, and he does too, the scrape of metal loud in the room. I hear distant laughter, but here in the hall, we are alone. My hands are sweating, but this has the feeling of inevitability, as though this is what I was careening toward the whole time. My whole life.
You can't beat me,
Maddock says, moving into a fighting stance. I already have, I say.
You have no way to win.
Maddock flicks his blade, encouraging me to come toward him, as though this is just some practice bout.
What can you hope to do with one missing prince, here in Baelkin's stronghold? I will knock you down, and then I will take him from you. You could have had anything you wanted. But now you will be left with nothing.
Oh, yes. Let me tell you my whole plan. You've goaded me right into it. I make a face. Let's not stall anymore. This is the part where we fight.
At least you're no coward.
He rushes at me with such force that even though I block the blow, I am thrown to the floor. I roll into a standing position, but I am shaken. He has never fought me like this, full out. This will be no genteel exchange of blows. He's the High King's general. I knew he was better than me, but not how much better. I cheat a glance toward the window. I can't be stronger than him, but I don't need to be. I just need to keep on my feet a little while longer. I strike out, hoping to catch him by surprise. He knocks me back again. I dodge and turn, but he expects the blow, and I have to stumble inelegantly back, blocking yet another heavy chop of his blade. My arms hurt from the strength behind his blows. This is all happening too fast. I come in with a series of techniques he's taught me, and then use a bit of swordplay I learned from the ghost. I feign left, and then land a clever slice to his side. It's a shallow hit, but it surprises us both when a line of red wets his coat. He thrusts toward me. I jump to one side, and he elbows me in the face, knocking me back to the ground. Blood gushes over my mouth from my nose. I push myself dizzily to my feet. I'm scared, no matter how I try to play it off. I was arrogant. I am trying to buy time, but one of his blows could split me in half.
Surrender,
he tells me, sword pointed toward my throat.
It was well tried. I will forgive you, Jude, and we will go back into the banquet. You will persuade Cardin to do what I need him to. All will be as it should be.
I spit blood on the stone tiles. His sword arm trembles a little. You surrender, I say. He laughs, as though I have told a particularly rich joke. Then he stops, grimacing. I imagine you're not feeling quite yourself, I tell him. His sword sags a little, and he looks at me in sudden comprehension.
What have you done?
I poisoned you. Don't worry. It was a small enough dose. You'll live.
The cups of wine,
he says.
But how did you know which one I would choose?
I didn't, I tell him, thinking that he'll be at least a little pleased by the answer, despite himself. It is the kind of strategy he likes best. I poisoned them both.
You will be very sorry,
he says. The tremble is in his legs now. I know. I feel the echo of it in my own. But by now, I am used to drinking poison. I look deep into his eyes as I sheathe my sword. Father, I am what you made me. I've become your daughter, after all. Maddock lifts his blade again, as though he's going to rush at me one final time. But then it falls from his hand, and he falls too, sprawling on the stone floor. When the ghost and the roach come in, a few tense minutes later, they find me sitting beside him, too tired to even think of moving his body. Wordlessly, the roach hands me a handkerchief, and I start to wipe the blood from my nose.
On to phase three,
the ghost says. Chapter 30. When I rejoin the feast, everyone is taking their place at the long table. I walk straight to Baelkin and curtsy. My lord, I say, pitching my voice low. Maddock asked me to tell you that he is delayed and to begin without him. He wishes you not to worry, but some of Dane's spies are here. He will send you word when he's caught or killed them. Baelkin regards me with slightly pursed lips and narrowed eyes. He takes in whatever traces of blood I couldn't wash from my nostrils and my teeth, whatever sweat I couldn't wipe away. Maddock slumbers in Cardin's old room, and by my calculations, we have at least an hour before he wakes. It feels as though if Baelkin looked carefully, he could see that on my face too.
You have been more helpful than I would have guessed,
Baelkin says, resting a hand lightly on my shoulder. He seems to have forgotten how furious he was when I first came in with Cardin and expects me to forget too.
Continue, and you will find yourself rewarded. Would you like to live as one of us? Would you like to be one of us?
Could the High King of Faerie really give me that? Could he make me something other than human? Something other than mortal? I think of Valyrian's words when he tried to glamour me into jumping out of the tower. Being born mortal is like being born already dead. He sees the look on my face and smiles, sure that he has ferreted out the secret desire of my heart. And indeed, as I walk to my seat, I am troubled. I should feel triumphant. But instead, I feel sick. Outmaneuvering Maddock wasn't nearly as satisfying as I wanted it to be, especially since I was able to do it because he never thought of me as someone who would betray him. Perhaps years from now, my faith in this plan will prove justified. But until then, I will have to live with this acid in the pit of my stomach.
The future of Fairy depends on my playing a long game and playing it perfectly. I spot Vivi, sitting between Nikasia and Lord Severin, and I give her a quick smile. She gives me a grim one in return. Lord Roybin looks at me askance. Beside him, the green pixie whispers something in his ear, and he shakes his head. At the other end of the table, Locke kisses Taryn's hand. Queen Orla looks over at me curiously. There are only three mortals here. Taryn, me, and the redhead with Severin. And from the way she regards us, Orla is imagining mice presiding over a convocation of cats. Above hangs a chandelier made from thin sheets of mica. Tiny glowing fairies are trapped inside for the purpose of adding a warm glow to the room. Occasionally, they fly, making shadows dance.
Jude,
Locke says, touching my arm, startling me. His fox eyes crinkle in amusement.
I admit, I am a little jealous to see Cardin parading you around on his arm.
I take a step back. I don't have time for this.
I liked you, you know,
he says.
I like you still.
For a moment, I wonder what would happen if I hauled off and punched him. Go away, Locke, I tell him. His smile returns.
The thing I like best is how you never do what I imagine you will. For instance, I didn't think you'd duel over me.
I didn't. I pull away from him and head to the table, a little unsteady on my feet.
There you are,
Cardin says as I take my place beside him.
How has the night been going for you? Mine has been full of dull conversations about how my head is going to find itself on a spike.
My hands shake as I take my place. I tell myself that it's just the poison. My mouth is dry. I find myself without the wit for verbal sparring. Servants set down dishes, roasted goose shining with currant glaze, oysters and stewed ramps, acorn cakes and whole fish stuffed with rose hips. Wine is poured, dark green with pieces of gold floating in it. I watch them sink to the bottom of the glass, shining sediment.
Have I told you how hideous you look tonight?
Cardin asks, leaning back in the elaborately carved chair, the warmth of his words turning the question into something like a compliment. No, I say, glad to be annoyed back into the present. Tell me.
I cannot,
he says, then frowns.
Jude.
I may never be used to the sound of my name on his lips. His brows draw together.
There's a bruising coming up on your jaw.
I take a deep drink of water. I'm fine, I tell him.
It's not long now.
Baelkin stands and raises his glass. I shove back my chair so that I am on my feet when the explosion happens. For a moment, everything is so loud, it feels like the room is tilting sideways. The folk scream. Crystal goblets fall and shatter. The bomb has struck. In the confusion, a single black bolt flies from a shadowed alcove and sinks into the wooden table right in front of Cardin. Baelkin leaps to his feet.
There!
He shouts.
The assassin!
Knights run toward the roach, who leaps out of the gloom and shoots again. Another bolt flies toward Cardin, who pretends to be too stunned to move, just the way we practiced. The roach explained to Cardin in great detail how it would be much safer to be still, much easier to miss him that way. What we didn't count on is Baelkin. He knocks Cardin out of the chair, throws him to the floor, and covers Cardin's body with his own. As I stare at them, I realize how little I've understood their relationship. Because, yes, Baelkin hasn't noticed that the ghost has climbed onto the ledge with the blood crown. Yes, he sent his knights after the roach, allowing the bomb to bar the doors of this room. But he has also reminded Cardin of why not to go forward with this plan.
I have been thinking of Baelkin as the brother Cardin hated, as the brother who'd murdered their whole family. I'd forgotten that Baelkin is Cardin's family. Baelkin is the person who raised him when Dane plotted against him, when his father sent him from the palace. Baelkin is all he has left. And although I am sure Baelkin would make for a terrible king, one who would hurt Cardin along with many others, I am equally sure that he would give Cardin power. Cardin would be allowed to be cruel, so long as it was clear that Baelkin was crueler. Putting the crown on Baelkin's head was a safe bet. Much safer than trusting me, than believing in some future oak. He's pledged himself to me. I just need to take care he doesn't find some way around my commands. I am a beat behind, and it's harder to push through the crowd than I thought, so I am not where I told the ghost I would be. When I look up at the ledge, he's there, moving out of the shadow. He throws the crown, but not to me. The ghost tosses the crown to my identical twin. It falls at Taryn's feet. Vivi has taken Oak's hand. Lord Roybin is pushing through the crowd. Taryn picks up the crown. "Give it to Vivi," I call to her. The ghost, realizing his mistake, draws his crossbow and points it at my sister. But there's no way to shoot his way out of this. She gives me a terrible, betrayed look. Cardin struggles to his feet. Baelkin is up too, striding across the room.
"Child, if you do not give that to me, I will cut you in half,"
Baelkin tells Taryn.
"I will be the High King, and when I am, I will punish any who inconvenienced me."
She holds it out, looking between Baelkin and Vivi and me. Then she looks at all the lords and ladies watching her.
"Give me my crown,"
Baelkin says, walking toward her. Lord Roybin steps into Baelkin's path. He presses his hand to Baelkin's chest.
"Wait."
He hasn't drawn a blade, but I see the shine of knives under his coat. Baelkin tries to push Roybin's hand away, but he does not move. The ghost has his crossbow trained on Baelkin, and every eye in the room is watching him. Queen Orla is several steps away. Violence hangs heavily in the air. I move toward Taryn to get in front of her. If Baelkin draws a weapon, if he throws away diplomacy and simply charges, the room seems ready to explode into bloodshed. Some will fight on his side, some against. No vows to the crown matter now, and watching him murder his own family hasn't left anyone feeling safe. He has brought the lords and ladies of Faerie here to win them over. Even he seems to see that more murder is unlikely to do that. Besides, the ghost can shoot him before he gets to Taryn, and he wears no armor under his clothes. No matter how heavy the embroidery, it will not save him from a bolt to the heart.
"She's only a mortal girl," he says.
"This is a lovely banquet, Baelkin, son of Eldred," Queen Orla says, "but sadly lacking in amusements before now. Let this be our entertainment. After all, the crown is secure in this room, is it not? And you or your younger brother are the only ones who can wear it. Let the girl choose whom she will give it to. What does it matter if neither of you will crown the other?"
I am surprised. I thought Queen Orla was his ally. But then I suppose Nicasia's friendship with Cardin might have made her favor him. Or perhaps she favors neither of them and only wants the sea to have greater power by diminishing the power of the land.
"This is ridiculous," he says. "What of the explosion? Didn't that entertain you sufficiently?"
"It certainly piqued my interest,"
Lord Roybin says.
"You seem to have lost your general somewhere as well. Your rule hasn't even formally begun, but it certainly appears chaotic.
I turn to Taryn and close my fingers over the cool metal of the crown. Up close, it is exquisite. The leaves seem to grow out of the dark gold, to be living things, their stems crossing over one another in a delicate knotwork. Please, I say, there's still so much that's bad between us. So much anger and betrayal and jealousy. What are you doing? Taryn hisses at me. Behind her, Locke is looking at me with an odd gleam in his eyes. My story just got more interesting. And I know how much he loves story above all else. The best I can, I say. I tug. And for a long moment, Taryn holds fast. Then she opens her hand, and I stagger back with the crown. Vivi has brought Oak as close as she dares. Oriana stands with the crowd, clasping and unclasping her hands. She must notice Maddox's absence, must be wondering what I meant when I spoke of a price. Prince Cardin, I say, this is for you. The crowd parts to let him through. The other key player in this drama. He walks to stand to one side of me and Oak.
Stop! Bailkin shouts. Stop them immediately!
He draws a blade, clearly no longer interested in playing politics. Around the room, more swords are unsheathed in a terrible echo of his. I can hear the hum of enchanted steel in the air. I reach for Nightfell at the moment the ghost lets his bolt fly. Bailkin staggers back. I hear the sound of indrawn breaths all around the room. Shooting the king, even if he's not wearing a crown, is no small thing. Then, as Bailkin's sword falls to the ancient rug, I see where he was shot. His hand is pinioned to the dining table by a crossbow bolt, one that appears to be iron.
Cardin,
Bailkin calls.
I know you. I know that you'd prefer I did the difficult work of ruling while you enjoyed the power. I know that you despise mortals and ruffians and fools. Come, I have not always danced to your piping, but you haven't the stomach to truly cross me. Bring me the crown!
I gather Oak close to me and put the crown into his hands, so that he can see it, so that he can get used to holding it. Vivi pats him encouragingly on his back.
Bring me the crown, Cardin!
Bailkin says. Prince Cardin turns on his elder brother, the same cool and calculated gaze with which he has regarded so many other creatures before he's torn the wings from their back, before he's cast them into rivers or sent them from the court entirely.
No, brother. I do not think that I will. I think that if I did not have another reason to cross you, I would do it for spite.
Oak looks up at me, searching for confirmation that he's doing okay in the face of all this shouting. I nod with an encouraging smile. Show Oak, I whisper to Cardin. Show him what he's supposed to do. Kneel down.
They're going to think,
he starts, but I interrupt him. Just do it. Cardin kneels, and a hush goes through the crowd. Swords are returned to sheaths. Movement slow.
Oh, this is amusing,
says Lord Roybin in a low voice.
Who might that child be? Or whose?
He and Queen Annette share a very unseely smile.
See?
Cardin says to Oak, and then makes an impatient gesture.
Now the crown.
I look around at the lords and ladies of Faerie. Not one of their faces is friendly. All of them appear wary, waiting. Bailkin's expression is wild with fury, and he pulls against the bolt as though he might rip his hand in half before he allowed this to happen. Oak takes a hesitant step toward Cardan, then another.
Phase four,
Cardan whispers to me, still believing we're on the same side. I think of Matic, dozing away upstairs. All his dreams of murder. I think of Oriana and Oak, being forced apart for years. I think of Cardan, and how he will hate me. I think of what it means to make myself the villain of the piece. For the next full minute, I command you not to move, I whisper back. Cardan goes utterly still.
Go ahead, Vivi says to Oak, just like we practiced.
And with that, Oak puts the crown down on Cardan's head to rest on his brow.
I crown you.
Oak's little kid voice is uncertain.
King. High King of Faerie.
His eyes go to Vivi, to Oriana. He's waiting for one of them to tell him he did well, that he is done. People gasp. Baelkin gives a howl of fury. There is laughter and outrage and delight. Everyone likes a surprise. And the folk like one more than almost anything else. Cardan looks at me with helpless rage. Then, the full minute of my command up, he rises slowly to his feet. The fury in his eyes is familiar. The glitter of them like banked fire. Like coals burning hotter than flames ever could. This time, I deserve it. I promised he was going to be able to walk away from the court and all its manipulations. I promised he would be free from all this. I lied. It's not that I don't want Oak to be the High King. I do. He will be. But there's only one way to make sure the throne remains ready for him while he learns everything he needs to know. And that's if someone else occupies it. 7 years, and Cardan can step down, abdicate in Oak's favor, and do whatever he wants. But until then, he's going to have to keep my brother's throne warm. Lord Roybin sinks to one knee, as he promised.
My king,
he says. I wonder what that promise will cost. I wonder what he will ask us for, now that he has helped give Cardan a crown. And then the cry goes up around the room, from Queen Annet to Queen Orla and Lord Severin. From the other side, Taryn stares at me, clearly shocked. To her, I must seem mad to put someone I despise on the throne. But there is no way for me to explain myself. I sink to my knees along with everyone else, and so does she. All my promises have come due. For a long moment, Cardan just looks around the room. But he has little choice, and he must know it.
Rise,
he says. And we do. I step back, fading into the throng. Cardan has been a prince of Faerie all his life. No matter what he wants, he knows what's expected of him. He knows how to charm a crowd. How to entertain. He orders the broken glass cleared away. He has new goblets brought out, new wine poured. The toast he gives, to surprises and to the benefits of being too drunk to show up for the first coronation, causes all the lords and ladies to laugh. And if I notice that his hand grips his wine glass tightly enough to turn his knuckles white, then I imagine I'm the only one who does. Yet I am surprised when he turns to me, eyes blazing. It feels as though the room is empty but for us. He lifts his glass anew, mouth curving in a mockery of a smile.
And to Jude, who gave me a gift tonight, one that I plan to repay in kind.
I try not to visibly flinch as glasses lift around me. Crystal rings. More wine flows. More laughter sounds. The bomb elbows me in the side. "We came up with your code name," she mouths. I hadn't even seen her come in past the locked doors. What? I feel as tired as I have ever felt. And yet, for 7 years, I will not be able to truly rest. I expect her to say, "The liar." She gives me a tricksy grin, full of secrets. What else? The queen. It turns out, I still don't know how to laugh. Epilogue. I stand in the middle of Target, pushing the cart while Oak and Vivi pick out bedsheets and lunchboxes, skinny jeans and sandals. Oak looks around in mild confusion and pleasure. He keeps picking up things, puzzling over them, and then setting them down again. In the candy aisle, he adds bars of chocolate to the cart, along with jelly beans, lollipops, and chunks of candied ginger. Vivi doesn't stop him, so I don't either. It's odd to see Oak with his horns glamored away, his ears looking as round as mine. It's odd to see him in the toy aisle, trying out a scooter with an owl-shaped backpack over one arm. I expected that it would be hard to persuade Oriana to let him go with Vivi, but after Cardin's coronation, she agreed that Oak being away from the court for a few years was for the best. Baelkin is imprisoned in a tower. Madoc woke in a rage, only to find that his moment for seizing the crown was past.
"So, he's really your brother, right?" Heather asks Vivi as Oak kicks off on the scooter, flying through the greeting card aisle. "You could tell me if he was your son."
Vivi laughs delightedly. "I've got secrets, but that's not one of them." Heather wasn't thrilled about Vivienne showing up with a child and a half-baked explanation about why he had to live with her, but she didn't kick them out. Heather's sofa pulled out into a bed, and they agreed he could sleep there until Vivi found a job and they were able to afford a larger apartment. I know Vivi isn't going to get conventional work, but she will be fine. She will be better than fine. In another world, given our parents and our past, I would have kept on encouraging Vivi to trust Heather with the truth. But for now, if she feels like she has to keep the deception going, I am hardly in a position to contradict her. As we stand in the checkout line and Vivi pays for her haul with leaves glamored to seem like bills, I think again of the aftermath of the banquet-turned-coronation, of the blur of folk eating and joking, of everyone marveling over Oak, who appeared both pleased and panicked, of Oriana, clearly not sure whether to congratulate me or to slap me, or Taryn, quiet, considering, holding tightly to Locke's hand, of Nikasia giving Cardin a lingering kiss on his royal cheek. I have done the thing, and now I must live with what I have done. I have lied, and I have betrayed, and I have triumphed. If only there was someone to congratulate me. Heather sighs and smiles dreamily at Vivi as we load our purchases into the trunk of Heather's Prius. Back at the apartment, Heather takes some pre-made pizza dough out of her fridge and explains how to make personal pies.
"Mom will visit me, won't she?"
Oak asks as he places pieces of chocolate and marshmallows on top of his dough. I squeeze his arm as Heather sticks the food in the oven.
"Of course she will. Think of being here with Vivi as an apprenticeship. You learn what you need to know, and then you come home."
"How will I know when I've learned it, since I don't know it now?" he asks.
The question sounds like a riddle.
"Come back when returning feels like a hard choice instead of an easy one," I answer finally.
Vivi looks over, as though she's overheard. Her expression is thoughtful. I eat a slice of Oak's pizza and lick the chocolate off my fingers. It's sweet enough to make me wince, but I don't mind. I just want to sit with them a few more moments before I have to fly back to Faerie alone. When I dismount from my ragwort steed, I head to the palace. I have rooms there now. A vast sitting area, a bedroom behind latching double doors, and a dressing area with empty closets. All I have to hang in them is what I took out of Maddox's estate and a few things I got at Target. Here is where I will live. To keep Cardin close. To use my power over him to ensure things go smoothly. The Court of Shadows will grow beneath the castle, fed on being both the High King's spies and his keepers. They'll have their gold, straight from the king's hand. What I have not done, not really, is spoken with Cardin. I left him with only a few commands, the familiar hatred in his face enough to make a coward out of me. But I am going to have to talk to him eventually. There is no profit in my putting it off any longer. Still, it is with a heavy heart and leaden steps that I make my way to the royal rooms. I knock, only to be told by a prim-seeming manservant with flowers braided in his blonde beard that the High King has gone to the Great Hall. I find him there, lounging on the throne of Faerie, looking out from the dais. The room is empty except for us. My footfalls echo as I move across the floor. Cardin is dressed in breeches, a waistcoat, and another coat over that, fitted in his shoulders, tapered in sharply at the waist, and falling to his mid-thigh. The cloth is uncut velvet in a deep burgundy, with ivory velvet at the lapels, shoulders, and waistcoat. Stitching in golden thread covers the whole, matched by golden buttons and golden buckles on his tall boots. At his throat is a ruff of pale owl feathers. His black hair falls in opulent curls around his cheeks. The shadows bring out the sharpness of his bones, the length of his lashes, the merciless beauty of his face. I am horrified by how much he looks like the King of Faerie. I am horrified by my own impulse to bend my knee to him, my own desire to let him touch my head with a ringed hand. What have I done? For so long, there was no one I trusted less. And now I must contend with him, must match my will to his. His oath does not seem enough of an antidote against his cleverness. What in the world have I done? I keep walking, though. I keep my expression as cold as I know how. He's the one who smiles, but his smile is colder than any stiff face could be.
A year and a day, he calls out. Blink, and that will be over. And what will you do then?
I draw closer to him. I hope I can persuade you to remain king until Oak is ready to return.
Maybe I will acquire a taste for ruling, he says coolly. Maybe I won't ever want to give it up.
I don't think so, I say. Although I've always known that was one possibility. I've always known that removing him from the throne might be harder than putting him there. I have a bargain with him for a year and a day. I have a year and a day to come to a bargain for longer than that, and not for 1 minute more. His grin widens, shows teeth.
I don't think I will be a good king. I never wanted to be one. Certainly not a good one. You made me your puppet. Very well, Jude, daughter of Matic. I will be your puppet. You rule. You contend with Baelkin, with Roybin, with Orla of the Undersea. You be my seneschal. Do the work, and I will drink wine and make my subjects laugh. I may be the useless shield you put in front of your brother, but don't expect me to start being useful.
I expected something else. A direct threat, perhaps. Somehow, This is worse. He rises from the throne.
Come. Have a seat.
His voice is replete with danger, lush with menace. The flowering branches have sprouted thorns so thickly that petals are barely visible.
This is what you wanted, isn't it?
He asks.
What you sacrificed everything for? Go on. It's all yours.
Belinda Audio and Hotkey Books hope you enjoyed the reading of
The Cruel Prince. Written by Holly Black. Read by Caitlin Kelly.
Our audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular among travellers, families, and people who are on the go. If you really enjoyed this audiobook, please introduce your friends and family to the experience. We're sure they'll love you for it. If you want to hear more about our fabulous range of titles, please visit us online at belinda.com. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you.